Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to the Moving Image Podcast, where we discuss the infinite topics of classic films, classic music, social issues, and all things cultural. Our exciting guest today hails from Los Angeles by way of Australia, and I am so excited to have him on the show today. My name is Robert B., and my guest is Martin Turnbull, and he's the author of several books, including The Heart of a Lion and The Garden of Allah series. Welcome, Martin Turnbull, to The Moving Image.
Hi, Robert, and hello, everybody listening.
Hey, Martin, glad to have you. So I know you're originally from Australia. Talk a little bit about your early life and how you wound up traveling to California and settling there.
Well, I'm from Melbourne, Australia, where I was always a movie-struck kid, not just the latest movies, but I feel like I spent my childhood watching reruns of old Hollywood movies on TV. This was before VHS and home video and all that kind of stuff. So I was always watching old movies on TV, never thinking for a minute that I would end up living in LA. That kind of came about 25 years ago. I guess you could say I was headhunted for a job in LA. I worked in the travel industry, and there was a job going for an Australian and New Zealand travel company over here who needed somebody, and I fit the bill, and I was offered the job, and I thought, well, that sounds like a grand adventure. The job was supposed to last 3 years, and, you know, life happens, and stuff happens, and things change, and circumstances evolve, and 25 years later, here I am writing about it in my historical novels.
So the rest is history, as they would call it. So, Martin, when you first got to L.A., was it everything you imagined from watching the movies and hearing about?
Well, I worked in travel, so I had been to L.A. several times, so I was fairly familiar with it. But I have to say that in all the times that I was here, uppermost in my mind was, I'm not far from Warner Brothers. I'm not far from the MGM. I'm not far from where the movie magic got sprinkled on the audiences of the world. And I was always quite enthralled. So viewing LA was always viewed by me through, you know, rose-colored glasses of being so close to the things that I love to watch. So for me, yeah, it kind of was. It was the land of sunshine, the land of palm trees, the land of movie studios and entertainment and Hollywood Boulevard and Sunset Boulevard and everything in between. I now know a lot more about the history of this place than I did back when I was visiting. But for me, it always held that sort of allure.
So you were like a kid in a candy store, sort of, right?
No sort of about it. That's exactly what I was.
So, Martin, I see at one time you worked as a private tour guide. That must have been interesting.
Right. That was a great job. It was for a company that personalized tour. So if you just wanted a bus tour around Beverly Hills, this wasn't for you. This is a company, and they're still around, that is basically you and the driver in the car. So wherever you want to go, whatever you want to do, we can put together a tour for you, or we can just make it up as we go along. Some people didn't really know what was what and what was where. So I said, you know what? Let's just take you on a drive around LA. If we see something we like, we can stop and you can take photos, or we can go for a walk. Or if people wanted a movie-centric tour or a garden-centric tour, or they just wanted to see downtown because downtown is where the history is, that's fine. It's just us, so we can go, we can roam LA as we please. And if we time it right with the right traffic on the right day, you can see a lot in a day when it's just the two of you in a car. So no two tours were the same, because no two customers had the same interests. So it was a job that there was no getting bored, and I never bored of telling stories and the fun facts of the things that I knew as I was taking these people around.
Yeah, and we're excited to hear it and listen to it. So you really were enamored with classic Hollywood and Hollywood from a young age when you were a kid.
Yeah.
But at what point did you decide, hey, I want to write about this. I want to write some novels about classic Hollywood. What point was that?
Well, I had always wanted to write a novel, or just see if I could write a novel. And
right.
So one day I thought, you know what, let's just see if I can. And I had an idea, and I wrote the novel. That took about 3 years to do. And when I finished with it, it was okay. It was all right. It wasn't really publishable. So then I had another idea. I wrote another novel. And that was better, still not good enough. Then I had a third idea, and that was better again, but there still wasn't something special enough in the plot or the characters or the central hook. It wasn't quite there yet. So I needed an idea that made me go, oh, you know what? Now that's something I can do something with. And then one day I was online clicking around as you do, and I came across an article about this hotel on Sunset Boulevard called the Garden of Allah. And I started reading it. And the hotel had a long list of very famous people, or soon to be famous people at the time, who stayed there. And so I'm reading about how Bogie and Bacall stayed there, and Errol Flynn and David Niven, and half the Algonquin Round Table, Robert Benchley, Dorothy Parker, and then later on Frank Sinatra, Harpo Marx, Orson Welles. It was like one name after another, and I'm thinking, I have been reading about these people at this time since I was a teenager, and how have I not heard of this place? I thought, well, somebody must have written a book about it, because this is kind of amazing. This caliber of people checking in and out of the hotel right at the gateway of the Sunset Strip, somebody must have done something with this. So I took a look around, and I found one person had read one book. And that book was by Sheila Graham, who was a gossip columnist who I'd never heard of.
Right.
She was just behind Luella Parsons and Hedda Hopper. So she had dated F. Scott Fitzgerald, who had also stayed at the Garden, and they had been dating while he was staying at the Garden. So she wrote a book in 1970 about it. So a nonfiction book, a history of the place. So I checked that book out of the library, and within 10 pages, I knew exactly what I wanted to do, because this hotel opened in 1927, just a couple of months before the jazz singer introduced the talkies, and it closed
right.
in 1959 when the remake of Ben-Hur was sort of one of the last hurrahs of the Hollywood studio era blockbusters. So for me, 27 to 59 were the years of golden Hollywood, and this hotel was open from 27 to 59. And I thought, I could tell the history of the studio era years of Hollywood through the eyes of the people who stayed there, because it actually existed. These people actually stayed there. So do a series of novels, because this is 30 years where a lot happens. and I can't, that's too much for one book. So I instantly, okay, this is a series of books, because that's going to take me a long time to tell this story. So I somehow immediately knew the three fictional characters I wanted to tell the story through. And one is a gossip columnist, one is an actress, and one's a screenwriter. And so between the three of them, I figured I could cover Hollywood in all its glory, in front of the camera, behind the camera, at Ciro's and the Cambo, and talk to the shoe shiners at the Ambassador Hotel. I could pretty much cover everything I wanted to cover plausibly by telling the story through the eyes of these people as they're living at the Garden of Allah, and their neighbors are, you know, Frank Sinatra and Orson Welles. So that's what I did. I set about researching it, because all of these people who stayed at the Garden of Allah, they all wrote a memoir because they all had interesting lives. These were articulate, ambitious people who led big lives, and so they wrote autobiographies. And if they didn't, somebody wrote a biography about them. So I sat on my couch for a year, biographies, and bit by bit, I put together a timeline of what happened in Hollywood, when it happened, who it happened to, and what was the result of that. And so after a year of that, I had a very detailed timeline of the history of Hollywood, around which I wrote my fictional story. And that was how it all started.
Wow. Bogey, Bacall, Orson Welles, the Algonquin Roundtable, all heavyweights.
Yeah.
So let me ask you about the book per se. Did you find a mainstream publisher for the first book, or did you publish it on your own?
I published it on my own. When I was starting to look for a literary agent, the ability to publish your own work had really only just started. So this is 2011. And it wasn't quite on my horizon, but finding a literary agent is a very long process. And I ended up contacting, I think it was 86 literary agents about this first book of the series that I had written. And I got a lot of interest, but ultimately they all said no. But contacting that many literary agents, that took me 6 months. So those were the 6 months that the ability to publish your own work landed on my horizon. And the more I looked into it, the more I liked the proposition, because I could write what I wanted to write, how I wanted to write it, when I wanted to write it, and publish it according to my schedule. I had the say in the cover design and in the marketing. I had a lot more control, and that suited me better. So by the time the 68th literary agent said, thanks, but no thanks, I thought, well, actually, who needs you? So I went ahead and I published each book on my own, which is what I've done ever since.
Now, on the Garden of Allah story, legend has it that the silent film actress Alla Nazimova acquired the Sunset Boulevard property from developer William H. Hay in 1919 and converted it into a residential hotel in 1926 by adding 25 villas around the residence, which opened as the Garden of Allah Hotel in January 1927. So Nazimova was actually instrumental in starting that off, huh?
Yeah, she was a very, very popular silent actress who came to Hollywood in the late teens with a huge contract with Metro Pictures. And for the first 5 or 6 years, she was very, very successful and earned a lot of money. But like a lot of these people, their ability to earn money wasn't matched with their ability to hang on to the money. So by the mid-20s, her career wasn't doing so well. And somebody came to her and said, you've got this 2.5 acres at the beginning of the Sunset Strip, this huge backyard. You could turn it into a hotel as an ongoing cash flow in case this movie career of yours that seems to be dying, in case it doesn't pick up, you'll have a plan. And she thought, well, that's a good idea. So that's what she did. So she opened the hotel in 27. But by then, she had been living there for 6 or 7 years. And by that stage, her address was well known within Hollywood because what she used to do was hold these salons, much like Gertrude Stein was doing in Paris. She would gather these intellectuals and academics in her living room, and on Saturday nights, she and these friends would talk about drama and novels and history and philosophy and art. And so it became known as an interesting place where people, interesting people, gather to talk about interesting things. And that was the Saturday night. They evolved into Sunday afternoons where she would gather women only. She would have women only pool parties. So she was also bisexual. And so this address had quite a wide-ranging reputation of an intellectual salons, and also the slightly scandalous, although this was the early 20s, the roaring 20s, where that kind of thing wasn't quite so scandalous as it would later become. So it was just known around town. Mazumova's place was an interesting place. So when she opened it as a hotel, it had instant name recognition, and it was a success right from the very start.
So fascinating. But I want to spend some time discussing your latest novel called The Heart of a Lion, a novel of Irving Thalberg's Hollywood. Now, so many people, Martin, don't know the name Thalberg. Who was Irving Thalberg?
Okay, so Irving Thalberg was a young man from Brooklyn, discovered by Carl Laemmle, who was the owner of Universal Studios. And he was very well educated because he wasn't a very well person. And he spent a lot of his boyhood in bed by himself, reading every book under the sun. So he was very intellectual, very educated, and a man of great taste. But he was also young for his years. So when Carl Laemmle sent him to L.A. to fix Universal Studios, he wasn't taken seriously at first because he was this young, pale lad who nobody thought would live to see 30. But he was able to do the job that was required of him, which was to turn the studio around. And in doing that, he came to the attention of Louis B. Mayer, who ran Mayer Productions. And he hired away from Universal, and together they participated in the merger of Metro Goldwyn Mayer. Actually, it was Metro and Goldwyn, and then later Mayer came along. But the two of them took and also ran studio and built it into the biggest and most successful studio in Hollywood, because Louis B. Mayer and Irving Thalberg were two sides of the same coin. Louis B. Mayer, I don't think he made it out of grade school in terms of education, but he was very good at business, very good with money, and knew how it all worked, whereas Irving had a very good sense of story, had a very good sense of people, and a very good sense of casting. So while Mayer took care of the business side of things, Thalberg took care of the creative side of things. He loved writers. He respected actors. He also loved the movies. So it was due to Irving Thalberg that MGM just wasn't a studio. It was the studio, sometimes referred to as the Tiffany Studio, because he was able to shepherd more movies onto the screen and to ensure that those movies became hits better than anybody else in the industry. But by the same token, he had a very weak heart, so he lived day to day knowing that a heart attack could take him down at any time. He also was told by every doctor under the sun that he would be lucky to see 30, and so I think that he lived his life going full out because tomorrow could be the end. So he worked very hard to do the things he wanted to achieve while he could achieve them, because tomorrow that heart attack could come. And in doing so, he raised the art of motion pictures more than anybody else. but he died at 36. And I think that's why most people don't know him, because the other legends of the industry, like Louis B. Mayer, Daryl Zanuck, David O. Selznick, Harry Cohn, and all the movie stars, they lived for decades. But Irving Thalberg, who pretty much invented the studio system, died at 36 in the mid-30s and was largely forgotten. In fact, he would probably be completely forgotten, but there is an honorary Oscar in his name, and it's given to people who contribute significantly to the film industry. So without that Oscar, I think most people would have completely forgotten about him. And he's the subject of a couple of biographies, a couple of very good biographies. But I felt he's like Alan Azimova, really, like Alan Azimova, who opened the Garden of Allah. Their lives were too interesting to be forgotten about. So that's why I wrote a novel about Irving Thalberg and called it The Heart of the Lion, because the lion was Leo the Lion from MGM.
Right.
And the heart is because in spite of his achievements, he always knew that his heart wasn't very strong and it would be the end of him sooner or later. And so it tells the story of Irving Thalberg's successful attempt to do what he could while he could. And I thought that would make for an interesting story.
Yeah, I agree. So let me ask you, Martin, what were some of the great MGM films that Thalberg produced and guided?
Oh, gosh. I'm going to take the easy way out and say any MGM movie made between 1924 and, well, really before that, even the early 20s, 1936, he had a hand in. He had his finger in every film and in every part of every film. He made sure that the casting was correct, that the script was correct, that the editing was correct. And if he was the one who invented the sneak previews and test audiences, because he knew that a film is only as good as it plays in front of an audience. So before they rolled a movie out, they wanted to see the reaction in front of a live audience. So he had a streetcar fitted out for MGM, and he had a streetcar line built into the studio, so when it came time to test a film, they would take their private streetcar to Pasadena, to Glendale, to Huntington Beach, and play a movie for an audience so that they could test the reactions. Because he wasn't always right. The audience didn't always react the way he thought they would, but he wasn't making a movie for him. He was making a movie for them, so he needed to know that they reacted to the movies the way he wanted to. So his finger was in every department of every movie that MGM made in those years. So keep in mind, when MGM got going, they were making a feature movie a week. That's a lot of movies, and that's a lot to keep your finger on the pulse of, but I don't know, somehow he managed to do it while also marrying the queen of the lot. And having a couple of kids and having a social life as well. I don't know how he fitted all that in, but, you know, when you've got a ticking clock hanging over your head, it's amazing how many hours you can fill in a day.
Yeah, well, you just went into another one of the major, major storylines of Thalberg, and that was his storybook marriage to the top or one of the top MGM actresses, Norma Shearer. And talk a little more about that.
So the way I understand it is that Norma caught Norma's eye first, and she started hanging around his office trying to get his attention. And it may have been a little bit on the professional side, but he appealed to her as well. And he just thought he was hanging around with his secretary. Until she made it clear, like, actually, no, it's you that I like. And so their relationship developed slowly. And I think that it was a meeting of the minds. They both loved the movies. I think their relationship deepened as the years went on, when she saw how frail he actually was, but how brilliant he actually was. And theirs was a marriage that probably would have lasted the years had he not died in the mid-30s. Unlike most of the marriages around them, back then, as indeed now, marriages are kind of like tissues. You use them and then you throw them away. Theirs wasn't like that. Theirs was a marriage that they had to work at. But the king of the MGM lot marrying the queen of the MGM lot, and for that marriage to be a solid, real, quote-unquote, real marriage, was actually quite unusual in Hollywood. It's a shame that not more Hollywood marriages couldn't have been like theirs was.
I know Thalberg died at a very young age, as you mentioned, 36, and he was in poor health for the majority of his life. Do you go back in the book, do you talk about his early years in Brooklyn and how his family life was and his health back then and schooling? Do you discuss that in your piece?
Not directly. I reference it from time to time. But the focus of my story was how he was able to navigate his way to the top of the Hollywood heap. But in order to understand why that was such a challenge, I kind of go back from time to time in a sort of a fleeting flashback way and talk about how he developed scarlet fever and spent a year in bed. And also his mother. His mother was a lioness of a woman who adored her son. And she was not allowed to let any damn sickness get him. So she took very, very good care of him and made sure that he got absolutely everything he needed. And if the doctor said he needs to stay in bed for a year, which he did when he was about 15, she saw to it that he stayed in bed and he got the nutrition that he needed and the rest that he needed and the books that he needed. So she was, without him, he probably wouldn't have lived, actually. But she raised him according to what he needed, which was more than what most boys at the time need. And so you can't write about a guy like that without demonstrating what his relationship, especially with his mother, was like. I do go back into it, yeah.
So as you said earlier, he had some children. He and Norma, did his children follow in their footsteps and were active in Hollywood and in movies and films, or did they lead different type of lives?
They led completely different kind of lives. They were Hollywood kids insofar as they had two parents who were very busy professionally. So they had governesses and boarding schools and were sent away a lot. And so they weren't, as my understanding is, they weren't particularly close to Irving and Norma, especially as Irving died so young, when the kids were still young. So the son, Irving Jr., ended up becoming an academic, and he lived in Chicago. And the daughter, I don't know what she did with most of her life, but she ended up in Colorado, and she ended up running a bookstore. And I think like a some sort of vegan restaurant or health food restaurant or something in Colorado, in Aspen, I think. They both went on to have happy, fulfilled lives, but Hollywood wasn't in their blood, which is kind of ironic considering their parents were the leading lights of Hollywood of their era. But maybe in spite of that, maybe because they didn't see a lot of their parents, they weren't really enamored with the whole Hollywood scene. So no, they left it behind.
So Martin, switching gears, I know that you're pretty active on Twitter, and I notice you tweet a lot about old Hollywood buildings and streets, pretty cool places that engage many people who like and make comments on your tweets. That must be fun.
It is. When I started researching for my Garden of Allen novels, I started collecting photos of the sorts of places that I wanted to write about, mainly for my own reference so that I could describe them accurately. And then I realized somehow I'd accumulated thousands of photos, and I thought, well, they're just sitting on my computer. Nobody's seeing any of them, but I find them really interesting. And if I find them really interesting, then surely other people will as well. So I started posting these vintage photos online. I post one per day on Facebook, on my website, and on Twitter, and give a little potted history about what it is, what it was, where it was, and something interesting about the photograph, like if there are no painted lines on the road or there's something interesting on the sidewalk or the building is still there. And when I can, I also post a photo of the same building or the same street corner as it looks today, because I'm endlessly fascinated by how things used to look and how they look today. So it's a way of sharing what I've learned about the history of LA with people who are similarly interested. And I just posted it for my own interest, and I thought, well, some people are going to enjoy this. And I've been really quite pleased and surprised about how many people enjoy these photos as much as I do. And being LA, there seems to be no end of photographs to share. So I really enjoy that.
Well, this has been the new and dynamic podcast called The Moving Image. Stay tuned for more exciting shows on all things classic. My special guest has been Martin Turnbull. Thank you so much, Martin, for dropping by.
Thank you.
It's been a pleasure. Good evening.